We would like to send out a special thanks to HelloFresh.com for supporting The Trail Went Cold. And we would like to thank you, the listeners, by giving you the chance to receive $30 off your first week of deliveries when you go to HelloFresh.com and use the offer code COLD30. That's COLD30. Enjoy the show.
June 12th, 1985. Concord, California. Dottie Kaler, a 41-year-old woman with a history of agoraphobia, is allegedly dropped off at a train station by her husband, Jewel Kaler, before she leaves on a trip. The following day, Jewel finds Dottie's car in another train station's parking lot with her purse inside, but Dottie does not return from her trip and is never heard from again. Over the next few years, suspicion would fall upon Jewel after some surprise revelations, including a secret engagement to another woman, an anonymous letter accusing him of murdering his wife, but no trace of Dottie is ever found. After that, the trail went cold.
It was hell living with Dottie. It was hell having her disappear the way that she did. And yet, since I've gotten here and gotten settled and into a new job and that whole problem is behind me, things are really pretty good.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today I am going to be covering a case which many of you folks have been requesting for a long time, the 1985 disappearance of Dottie Kaler. That sound clip you just heard was from an interview on Unsolved Mysteries with Dottie's husband, Jewel Kaler, and yes, that guy actually went on national television and said that things have been pretty good since his wife disappeared. This case was profiled on one of the earliest Unsolved Mysteries episodes, the very first one hosted by Robert Stack, as a matter of fact, and remains one of their most memorable segments ever, thanks in large part to Jewel Kaler's infamous interview. This segment is actually at the tail end of the very first Unsolved Mysteries episode you'll find on Amazon Prime, and since people have started revisiting the show again this past year, I've had a number of people say to me, "What is the deal with Dottie's husband? You have to cover this case on the podcast." Well, I've been building up to this one for a long time because there is a ton of information about this story not mentioned on Unsolved Mysteries. My primary sources are a 5-part series of articles about the case published in the Contra Costa Times by reporter Joan Morris in 2004, along with a 140-page probable cause affidavit that was used to obtain a search warrant for Dottie and Jewel's former home, which you can find on the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum. And from what I heard, it is extremely rare for a probable cause affidavit to be a whopping 140 pages long, which should give you an idea of how troublesome this case really is. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unsolved disappearance of Dottie Kaler. Our story begins in California in 1985. Our central figure is 41-year-old Dorothy Rusnak Kaler, who goes by the name Dottie and originally hails from Ohio. Dottie lives with her husband, Jewel Kaler, whom she has been married to for the past decade. They originally met in 1970 while Jewel was a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley, and believe it or not, for the first few months of their relationship, Dottie knew him as Jim Rupp. It turned out that Jewel had introduced himself to Dottie under a fake name to cover up the fact that he was already married and had a daughter. Even after Dottie found out, she decided to remain with Jewel. When Jewel divorced his wife, they got married and eventually settled in the city of Concord in the San Francisco Bay Area. Unfortunately, the Kalers' marriage would be filled with constant turmoil, and to put it mildly, Jewel was not the ideal husband. He worked as an entomologist and aerial photography specialist with the United States Forest Service, which meant he was often on the road teaching and photographing forest lands for weeks at a time. And Jewel did not hesitate to use his time away from home to cheat on Dottie constantly. At one point, Dottie figured out that Jewel was having an affair with a woman in Alaska, and went so far as to write her a letter in Alaska to inform her that she was Jewel's wife, which brought an end to that secret relationship. During this time period, Dottie also wound up struggling with agoraphobia, a fear of public places which prevented her from holding down a job, and pretty much kept her confined inside the house for years. Since Jewel was away working, Dottie was often left completely alone. At Thanksgiving in 1981, there would be an incident of domestic violence. After an argument over a checkbook, Jewel hit Dottie in the face with a typing stand, which prompted her to drive herself to the emergency room for treatment. Jewel maintained that Dottie had come after him with a pair of scissors and threatened to kill him, and that he only hit her in self-defense. Even though police got involved, and Dottie spent the night at a battered woman's shelter, both she and Jewel decided not to press charges. After the incident, Dottie asked Jewel for a divorce, but he refused, and it would be over 3 years before she could plan out a successful escape from the marriage. By the time 1985 rolled around, Jewel's position with the Forest Service's San Francisco office was being eliminated, so he accepted a transfer to a new job in Salt Lake City, Utah. Since Dottie had no interest in moving there, she decided to ask Jewel for a divorce again, and this time, the couple visited a mediator. They came to an agreement where Dottie would pay Jewel for his half of their house in Concord, so that she could remain there while he moved to Utah. Jewel planned to make a down payment on a new house he was wanting to purchase in West Jordan, and hoped to do so by refinancing the house in Concord, an idea which apparently led to a number of fights and arguments between him and Dottie. According to Jewel, Dottie wanted to leave on a train trip to visit a friend, but she never told him who this friend was, or where exactly she was going. Dottie told Jewel she wasn't planning to return until after June 24th, which is when he would leave and complete the move to Utah. Jewel agreed to give Dottie a ride to the Pleasant Hill Station for the Bay Area Rapid Transit, aka the BART train, on the morning of June 12th. Jewel claimed he drove Dottie to the station and that she was carrying her purse and overnight bag at the time. He then watched Dottie walk towards the station at around 8 a.m., and that's the last time he saw her. Now, the series of events which allegedly took place over the next 5 days are all Jewel's version of what happened, but here's his story. On June 13th, Jewel went to work at his office in San Francisco, but told his co-workers he wasn't feeling well and decided to leave early. He took the BART train home and got off at the Concord station at around 1 p.m. When he walked to his vehicle in the parking lot, he was surprised to find Dottie's Volkswagen Beetle parked in the spot right next to him. Jewel found this unusual because Dottie had left the Beetle behind at their house when she asked him to drive her to the Pleasant Hill BART station the previous day. Jewel had an extra key for the vehicle, so when he looked inside, he was surprised to find Dottie's purse on the front seat, which contained all her identification, including her driver's license, and her medications. According to Jewel, the only thing which appeared to be missing from the purse was a bee sting kit Dottie always carried around for her bee sting allergy, but the instructions for how to use the kit were still there. Jewel then proceeded to hide the purse under the front seat, lock the doors, and move the car to another spot so that it wouldn't receive a ticket. Jewel then left a note on the windshield letting Dottie know he'd moved the car and asked her to contact him. Well, when Jewel returned the following day, he claimed that the Beetle was in the same spot with his note still on the windshield, so over the course of the next few days, he kept moving the car to different parking spots and left two more notes on the windshield, along with a 4-page letter. Jewel was both compassionate and angry in the letter, telling Dottie he loved her and expressing concern for her well-being, but also blaming her for screwing up his life because she had not signed the refinancing papers for their house, even though he needed the money for the down payment on his new home in Utah. On June 16th, a friend of Dottie's named Shelley Wilson, who had been unable to reach her for days, called Jewel at the house, who told her what was going on with Dottie, and that he'd already reported her missing. Well, when Shelley contacted the Concord police, they had no record of any missing persons report for Dottie. The following day, Jewel spoke with a neighbor who happened to be a police officer, who advised him to file a report with the Bay Area Rapid Transit Police. After Jewel did so, it would be the BART police who reported Dottie missing to the Concord police. Dottie's sister, Diane Rusnak, would soon learn about her disappearance. Even though Jewel would tell police that he personally phoned Diane to let her know, Diane claimed this was not true, and that she was informed about the disappearance by one of Dottie's friends. Diane also found it odd that Jewel never made any attempt to contact her and ask if she'd seen Dottie during the entire time she was missing. It wasn't long before a number of holes began to emerge in Jewel's story, and alarm bells started going off in Diane's head. For starters, everyone found it odd that Dottie had gone on a trip out of town without telling Jewel where she was going or who she was visiting, and that she did not even leave a contact number in case he needed to reach her. Jewel reiterated that Dottie told him that she was not planning to return until after he left for Utah on June 24th because she, quote-unquote, wanted him to know what it felt like to be left alone. However, he became concerned when he discovered her vehicle in the BART station parking lot the day after she left. While there were no other witnesses who could place Dottie at the BART stations in Pleasant Hill or Concord, and the last witness beside Jewel who could confirm seeing Dottie alive was a garage mechanic who saw the couple visit his shop on June 11th and could sense some tension between them. On June 12th, the day Dottie allegedly left on her trip, Jewel went to work at the Forest Service field office in Pleasant Hill, but records show that he was only there for an hour and a half and then took 6.5 hours of sick leave. Like I mentioned previously, Jewel went to work at the main San Francisco office on June 13th and left early again because he wasn't feeling well. According to his co-workers, Jewel never returned after that, as he took the next week and a half off because he claimed he needed time to pack for his move. Well, the most alarming thing about Jewel's story is that if Dottie really was planning to return home on or after June 24th, like he said, she would have been shocked to discover that someone else was now living in her house. To everyone's surprise, Jewel packed up Dottie's belongings into a moving truck, repainted the inside of the house, put the house up for rent, and allowed new tenants to move in, and then completed his move to Utah on June 24th, taking most of Dottie's possessions with him. He even planned to have Dottie's Volkswagen Beetle towed there as well, until Diane angrily confronted Jewel at his house on June 19th. When Diane discovered that Dottie's possessions were already inside his moving truck, she demanded that Jewel give some of them back, and convinced him to leave Dottie's Beetle behind. Jewel claimed that he was forced to put the house up for rent because Dottie never put her signature on the refinancing papers. But the problem was that Jewel originally signed the rent contract on June 7th, 5 days before Dottie left, though oddly, the rental agent claimed that Dottie was in the room with Jewel while this happened. Jewel ultimately had to use his parents' home as collateral in order to secure a loan to make the down payment on his new home in West Jordan. Well, once a missing persons investigation was launched, Jewel was surprised to learn some things about Dottie which he did not know. For the past year, Dottie had been taking serious steps to battle her agoraphobia and gain more independence. She joined a support group called Women in Transition, which is where she met and became best friends with Shelley Wilson. The group helped Dottie get a handle on her anxieties and boosted her self-confidence. Without Jewel's knowledge, Dottie opened her own bank account, applied for her own credit cards, and rented a post office box to receive her own mail. She also asked Shelley to keep some of her most important documents, along with a cashier's check for $5,080, inside a file cabinet at her home. Many of Dottie's documents contained disturbing accounts of Jewel's infidelity and alleged abuse during their marriage. One particularly unsettling thing Dottie had written down is a story Jewel supposedly shared with her about how he once stuffed a bomb up the ass of a neighbor's sleeping dog when he was a child, and masturbated while he set it off. Dottie also wrote that after Jewel's ex-wife took him to court, he said he wanted to kill her by sneaking into her house while she was sleeping and slitting her throat. 6 months before her disappearance, Dottie had written a letter to Jules' mother in which she said, quote, "Jules threats to pop me off, as he puts it, may succeed, but in the long run won't get him anywhere. The neighbors are watching him now to help protect me, especially because of his 1981 violence against me. And if he carried through his murder threats, he'll just find himself sitting in jail for the rest of his life, or worse." According to her friends and fellow group members from Women in Transition, Dottie's time with them likely gave her enough courage to ask Jules for a divorce when he decided he wanted to move to Utah. Upon learning this, Jules began pushing forward the theory that she had disappeared voluntarily in order to start a new life somewhere. However, Dottie never touched her bank account, did not make any contact with her friends or family, and left behind everything she would have needed in order to start over, including the cashier's check, which expired in October of that year. Diane Resnack hired a private investigator named Francie Kaler to look into Dottie's disappearance, but no evidence could be found to prove Dottie was alive, or was even dropped off at the BART station like Jules claimed. And incidentally, Francie Kaler hosts her own podcast called PIs America and released an episode about Dottie in 2013, which you can find online. As for the police, they stopped short of calling Jules a suspect, but definitely believed he was a person of interest. The case wound up being featured on Unsolved Mysteries on November 29, 1987, where, of course, Jules agreed to be interviewed on the show and made a less than flattering attempt to maintain his innocence. And here's an amusing anecdote I heard on a commentary track from one of the Unsolved Mysteries DVD sets. Jules had his attorney in the room while his interview was filmed, and apparently, when Jules said his line about how things are pretty good since Dottie disappeared, the attorney immediately yelled out, "Cut!" In spite of this, his interview still aired, and it wasn't long before a surprise revelation about Jules would surface. The Unsolved Mystery segment generated a tip which soon led investigators to a Colorado woman who claimed she had been engaged to Jules at the time of Dottie's disappearance. They had originally met in May of 1984 while Jules was in Colorado on a work trip, and at Christmas that year, he proposed to her. As far as anyone knew, Dottie was not aware of Jules' secret engagement, and of course this other woman had no idea Jules was already married when she became involved with him. It was not until Jules invited her to his home in West Jordan for Christmas in 1985 that he finally told her about his marriage. That was a shocking enough revelation, but when Jules' daughter showed up at the house to visit and saw her father's engagement ring, she asked how he could be getting married while Dottie was still missing. Naturally, Jules' fiancé pushed for more information about this, and he proceeded to tell her how much he hated Dottie and how she had tried to kill him. He then stated, quote, "If I have to, I'll kill her first. As a matter of fact, she's gone, and if she is dead someplace, it's good riddance," end quote. Well, needless to say, this instantly brought an end to the engagement. This woman was so shook up that she left West Jordan as soon as she could and never had face-to-face contact with Jules again. When Jules' ex-fiancé learned about Dottie, some prior conversations she had with them suddenly became a lot more unsettling. Jules once shared a story about how his family dog had died, and he had buried it using a chemistry set which prevented the dog's body from smelling. He then mentioned that if he ever wanted to get rid of a person's body, he would try something similar. During the time period Dottie went missing, this woman phoned Jules in Concord, and he told her he was cleaning up a rental house because the tenants had, quote-unquote, slaughtered an animal inside, so he had to roll up a carpet and take it out of the house. Well, this phone call took place before Jules had actually rented out the house. When he was interviewed by police, Jules had mentioned dropping off a rug at his mother's house, but his mother did not recall this. Well, at the time the Unsolved Mysteries segment was filmed, no one involved with the case had any idea that Jules had been engaged to another woman. But this would not be the only major development brought on by the show. In January of 1988, the Concord Police Department received an envelope postmarked from Gary, Indiana, containing an anonymous handwritten letter. It started out with, quote, "To whom it may concern, Dottie was killed by her husband the morning she disappeared. It happened very early in the morning. He brought her out to the garage and struck her with a tire iron. The blow hit her right temple and killed her almost immediately," end quote. The writer then claimed that Jewel buried Dottie's body under a birch tree in a remote area of Concord where new homes were being built. The letter even included a sketch of the Kaler's garage, along with a hand-drawn map to the alleged burial location. It also provided a weird detail about an elderly woman who had supposedly seen Jewel and Dottie leaving together in their vehicle that morning. This woman waved to Dottie, unaware that she was dead at the time, and the writer stated that if this woman could be found and put under hypnosis, she might recall seeing a red splotch on Dottie's scarf. However, as far as I can tell, police were never able to pinpoint the burial location featured on the map. Years later, DNA testing was performed on the envelope's flap and its stamp. It uncovered DNA with male characteristics, but it was never matched to anyone. And while a document examiner thought the handwriting on the letter shared some similarities with Jewel's handwriting, it could not be conclusively determined if Jewel was the writer. In March of 1988, police were contacted by a woman who had been the office manager for State Farm Insurance in Salt Lake City. She spoke to Jewel shortly after he moved there because he wanted to remove Dottie's name from his insurance policy. Jewel would later make a pass at this woman by returning to her office with a rose, but she was not interested in him. However, she remembered a statement Jewel made during one of their conversations where he said he, quote-unquote, didn't believe in divorce, it would be easier to do away with them. At one point, Jewel told her about his job by showing her some aerial photos he'd taken of a forest, and this woman now wondered if Jewel might have been displaying the area where Dottie's body was buried. But this lead never went anywhere, and the case went dormant for a while. The next interesting development occurred in 1997 when Jewel's former next-door neighbor in Concord cut some ivy on a fence which divided his property from Jewel's former house. He was surprised to discover a rusted meat cleaver with duct tape on the handle underneath the ivy. The neighbor then recalled a conversation from before Jewel moved, where he advised him not to cut the ivy because it would cause the fence to collapse. The meat cleaver was turned over to the authorities, but provided no useful evidence. Jewel's neighbors had also remembered seeing him pouring a concrete patio in the backyard shortly after Dottie disappeared. Years later, ground-penetrating radar would detect some anomalies underneath this concrete, but I'm not sure if they ever dug it up. The case would be rejuvenated again in March of 2004, when reporter Joan Morris published a five-part series of articles about the case in the Contra Costa Times. By this point, Jewel was still living in Salt Lake City, and Morris attempted to interview him, but he did not say too much. In fact, his initial reaction was that he had completely forgotten about Dottie's disappearance. When the articles came out, Jewel was retired from his job at the Forest Service and making an attempt to run as a Libertarian candidate for the Utah House of Representatives. But once word got out that Jewel was a person of interest in the disappearance of his wife, he wound up withdrawing his candidacy. Nevertheless, Jewel continued to maintain his innocence, stating that he believed Dottie had disappeared voluntarily and was still alive somewhere, and that he was the victim of a smear campaign orchestrated by Dottie's sister, Diane Rusnak. The newfound publicity motivated the Concord police to reopen the investigation, and by 2005, they had written up a 140-page probable cause affidavit outlining many reasons why they believed Jewel was responsible for Dottie's disappearance, and used it to obtain a search warrant to search the Kaler's former home. They dug up the backyard and tested for blood and trace evidence, but failed to turn up any definitive proof that foul play had taken place. Jewel wound up getting involved in a legal battle with Diane Rusnak after Jewel successfully filed for divorce from Dottie in June of 2003 on the grounds of desertion. He was awarded all their marital property, including the house in Concord and 30 acres of land they owned in Oregon, but since Jewel never declared Dottie legally dead, Diane responded by filing a civil suit against him. Diane hoped that her sister could be declared dead so she could be appointed executor of her estate. However, the lawsuit has since wound up in limbo because the investigation into Dottie's disappearance has hit a dead end. While Jewel remains the primary person of interest, no evidence has ever surfaced to provide any answers about what happened to Dottie Kaler. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold.
But before we continue, I would like to take a moment to send out another huge thanks to our wonderful sponsor, HelloFresh. The Trail Went Cold has teamed up with HelloFresh, and they are offering everyone in our audience $30 off your first week of deliveries when you go to HelloFresh.com and use the offer code COLD30. Since the start of the new year,
I've received a number of meals from them, and their service is so convenient. Everything comes pre-measured and labeled meal kits, so you know which ingredients go with which recipe. HelloFresh offers a wide variety of chef-curated recipes that change weekly, and there are three plans to choose from: Classic, Veggie, and Family. I generally go with the meals from the Classic plan, and I've really enjoyed them. Just the other night, I had a delicious meal consisting of pan-seared steak with cipollini onions, roasted potatoes, and tomato pan sauce. I had this meal on a night where I was busy working on this very episode, so it was a relief not to have to spend all night in the kitchen, because HelloFresh's recipes only take around 30 minutes. When you're a podcaster who devotes a lot of your spare time to working on new episodes, you enjoy not having to plan dinner, spend money on takeout for an easy night, or worry about gathering ingredients week after week. After all, just because we have the word cold in our podcast title does not mean I like my meals that way. I always look forward to my weekly HelloFresh box delivery knowing that dinner just got easier. So to take advantage of this special offer, visit HelloFresh.com and use the code COLD30 to get $30 off your first week of deliveries. Once again, that's HelloFresh.com and the promo code is COLD30. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the show. So Unsolved Mysteries covered more than its fair share of cases where a victim was murdered or went missing, and their spouse was the prime suspect, and a surprisingly large number of these spouses agreed to be interviewed on the show in order to proclaim their innocence. But I'm not sure any of them made quite the impression that Jewel Kaler did. It's very rare to find someone who is suspected of potentially murdering their wife act so flippant about the whole thing. Regardless of whether you believe he's guilty or innocent, one indisputable fact is that Jewel was a terrible husband and a very, very strange human being. Before I begin delving into this case, I have to share a story about Jewel which doesn't really have anything to do with Dottie's disappearance, but is so bizarre that it has become immortalized by hardcore Unsolved Mysteries fans as the Wendy's Salad Bar story. It's mentioned in one of Joan Morse's articles from the Contra Costa Times, and I'm going to read the entire passage, word for word. Quote, "When employees at Wendy's complained about the mess he was allegedly making of their salad bar and asked him to leave, Jewel wrote an 8-page letter detailing how insulted he was and offering testimonials on how gifted he was at constructing salads. He even included a photograph of himself seated behind a salad worthy of a food stylist." Okay, I really think there are only three letters I can use to respond to that, and they are W, T, and F. I can tell you that I spent years working in customer service, and I'm sure many of you have as well, but I can't say I've heard an angry customer story quite like that one. And before you ask, no, the letter and the photograph of Jewel with the salad are not available online. Believe me, I've checked. I would certainly love to see it myself, because I have no idea how someone could fill 8 whole pages talking about their salad making skills. Well, from what I've read about Jewel, he loved writing long letters. Following Dottie's disappearance, he was asked by police to take a polygraph test, which he refused to do, and that's definitely his right, since polygraphs are not reliable. But Jewel wound up going the extra mile by sending police a 12-page letter outlining all the reasons he would not take a polygraph. Now, I'm sure after watching Jewel's interview on the Unsolved Mysteries segment for the first time, most people's knee-jerk reaction would be that he's guilty of sin, but I have to look at this case from all angles, as being an arrogant jerk does not necessarily make one a murderer. The fact of the matter is that Dottie and Jewel's marriage was on its last legs, and they were about to divorce and go their separate ways for good before Dottie went missing. So even though Jewel came off as very cold and uncaring during his Unsolved Mysteries interview, I can acknowledge the idea that he legitimately did not care that much about what happened to her. In many cases where women go missing and the husband is responsible, you'll often see them go on TV and pretend to be emotional as they cry crocodile tears and act like they were deeply in love and had the perfect marriage, when in actuality, the marriage was in serious trouble. Well, Jewel never went through that charade, and was very candid about the fact that his marriage to Dottie was not a happy one, and that he'd pretty much fallen out of love with her. even though she had gone missing, he did not consider her to be his problem anymore and had moved on with his life. While that's a pretty cold attitude to take, it does seem a bit more believable than those husbands who act like they care so deeply about their missing wife, but then are very uncooperative with the authorities and do nothing to aid in the searches to find them. Jewel always pushed forward the theory that Dottie could have disappeared voluntarily, and that taking off and leaving him in a financial bind and turning him into a potential murder suspect was her final act of revenge. In the majority of spousal disappearances, that idea is pretty absurd, but in this particular case, it is worth exploring. Dottie had no kids to leave behind, she clearly no longer wanted to be married to her husband, and after living as a recluse of agoraphobic for years, she was finally getting a fresh start. While I don't believe Dottie disliked her own family, it doesn't sound like she was particularly close to them. Back in the 1980s, it wasn't completely impossible for one to completely drop off the map and start a new life somewhere. However, over 30 years have passed, and there's been no trace of Dottie, and when you look at the circumstances of her life at the time she went missing, the idea of her orchestrating her own disappearance seems very unlikely. She was already getting a fresh start because her husband was moving out of state, so why would she need to travel elsewhere? After being trapped in a miserable marriage for years, Dottie had finally worked up the courage to ask Jewel for a divorce, and was finally going to have the freedom and independence to live on her own. This was a major step for someone who had battled agoraphobia, and her entire support system was in California. After living as a recluse for a long time, she finally made some friends in her Women in Transition group, so I see no reason why she would break off all contact with them in order to start a new life. It also doesn't make sense that Dottie would run off now that she had her own place to live after making an arrangement to stay in the house in Concord. She also left behind her $5,000 cashier's check, and for a woman who hadn't worked a job in many years, she was going to need every financial resource at her disposal in order to start afresh. The thing which really perturbed Dottie's friends from her support group was the fact that her purse had been left behind in her Volkswagen Beetle. In order to deal with her agoraphobia, Dottie always made it a point to keep most of her important items in her purse, including her medications. Whenever she left the house, she made sure all the items she felt she might need were inside there, which was an important step at helping her keep her anxieties at ease while she was in public. So the idea of her just skipping town and leaving her purse inside her car set off many alarm bells. Essentially, if Dottie did take off voluntarily, the only thing she would have had with her was the overnight bag Jewel claimed she had packed for her trip. There really is no way that a woman who barely set foot outside her house for years could disappear with virtually no resources at her disposal and manage to survive on her own for the next 3 decades. It's also worth noting that Dottie's parents have since passed away, and she still never resurfaced or made any attempt to contact her sister, so sadly, I really don't think she is still alive. Of course, there are other possibilities besides foul play. Dottie could have conceivably committed suicide somewhere, as this is the Bay Area, and there are numerous bridges a person could jump off of so that their body would never be found. But given that Dottie seemed to be the happiest she'd been in quite some time, it's very doubtful that she took her own life. Jewel has also pushed forward the theory that after leaving on her trip, perhaps Dottie ran into the wrong person and was murdered by an unknown third party. That's certainly not 100% impossible, but when you look at the number of holes in Jewel's story about what happened, then a disturbing picture begins to emerge. When you first watch the Unsolved Mystery segment, Jewel's story doesn't seem that unbelievable on the surface. It gives the impression that Dottie simply decided to take a quick train trip out of town, but didn't come back, which isn't completely implausible. But once I dug deeper into the case, and learned that Jewel had claimed that Dottie wasn't scheduled to return until after June 24th, at least 12 days after she left, then I realized his story made no sense. If Jewel is to be believed, then he just allowed Dottie to leave on a trip to see a friend without even learning who this friend was and getting any contact information in case he needed to reach her. Of course, the couple was on the verge of divorce, and they'd recently been fighting, and Dottie supposedly said she was not going to return until after Jewel moved to Utah, so that he'll finally know what it's like to be left alone, much like all the times he left her alone for weeks at a time during their marriage. But then the following day, Jewel finds Dottie's Beetle parked right next to his car at the Concord BART station, even though he had dropped her off the day before at the Pleasant Hill BART station, which is about 4 or 5 miles away. So if Dottie actually left her Beetle there, then that means she would have had to return from her trip, found her own transportation back home, and arrived there after Jewel left for work on June 13th, before driving the Beetle to the Concord BART station, where she happens to notice Jewel's car. And by sheer chance, the parking spot right next to him is empty, so she abandons her car there and decides to take off to God knows where, while inexplicably leaving her purse containing her most important personal items behind inside the vehicle. Now, anyone who's familiar with the Concord BART station has always stated that the parking lot is often filled to capacity on a weekday, so the odds against Dottie being able to find an open spot right next to her husband's car have got to be astronomical. And then there's the nature of those weird notes and the 4-page letter Jewel supposedly left for Dottie. They start off sounding very loving and caring, which, by all accounts, doesn't sound like something Jewel would write to Dottie at all. But then Jewel starts ranting about how Dottie has left him in a financial bind and screwed up his life because she never signed the refinancing papers for the house, so now he won't be able to make the down payment on his new home in Utah. Well, hold on a second. Didn't Jewel say that Dottie wasn't planning to come back until after June 24th, when he had already completed the move to Utah? If that's the case, why didn't he get Dottie to sign the refinancing papers before she left on her trip? If Jewel needs the money so badly, why would he drop Dottie off at the BART station without ensuring this was taken care of? And then, of course, against the wishes of Dottie's family and friends, Jewel then proceeded to rent out the house and took most of Dottie's possessions with him when he moved to Utah as scheduled on June 24th, even though, you know, Dottie told him she wasn't planning to return from her trip until after June 24th. Now, granted, Jewel could have changed his outlook when he discovered the vehicle in the BART station parking lot, but that's still an incredibly callous thing to do, and how could he be so certain that Dottie wouldn't eventually come back? When asked what Dottie was supposed to do if she returned home to find new tenants living in her house, Jewel replied that she could just come live with them in Utah. Of course, given that Jewel was secretly engaged to another woman at that time, and was making plans for her to move into his new house with him, that answer makes zero sense. Jewel also dragged his feet and took 5 days to report Dottie missing, and it seems like he only did so because Shelley Wilson had phoned him and he lied to her about it. But even if Jewel personally didn't give a crap about Dottie's well-being, wouldn't it be in his vested interest to find her as quickly as possible so that she could sign his refinancing papers? In addition, even though Jewel claimed he was forced to put the house up for rent because Dottie disappeared, it turned out that he originally signed the rental contract 5 days beforehand on June 7th. It seems that the more people were interviewed, the more holes opened up in Jewel's story. Another friend of Dottie's from her support group met Jewel at his house on the day Dottie was reported missing. By this point, Jewel had brought home Dottie's purse and he showed her its contents. She was certain she saw Dottie's bee sting kit in there, but was later surprised to learn that Jewel had reported the kit was missing, even though its instructions were left behind. Jewel also left work early on both June the 12th and 13th because he wasn't feeling well and took the next week and a half off. Granted, Jewel would have been pretty busy preparing for his move, and that is a logical reason to take all those days off from work. But when you learn Jewel spent that time repainting the inside of the house, boxing up all of Dottie's possessions, and essentially doing everything he could to purge her from his life, then it's easy to jump to some pretty horrifying conclusions. We have reports from the Kaler's next-door neighbors that Jewel was pouring a concrete patio during this time period, but if he killed Dottie, I'm not sure he would have been brazen enough to bury her body on the property, particularly if he was going to be renting it out to new tenants. I'm also not sure what to make of this same neighbor's discovery of the meat cleaver in the ivy 12 years later. Again, if Jewel used this cleaver to harm Dottie, it seems weird that he would just hide it on the property rather than dispose of it elsewhere. But putting aside the issues with Jewel's story, perhaps the biggest red flag is the discovery that he was secretly engaged to another woman at the time Dottie went missing. And they had initially gotten engaged 6 months earlier, long before Dottie told Jewel she wanted a divorce. Of course, this wasn't exactly anything new from Jewel, as he cheated on Dottie all the time, and became involved with her in the first place while he was married to someone else, and used a false name to boot. But it's really telling that when Jewel finally told the truth about Dottie to his new fiancé, she became so fearful that he'd harm Dottie that she broke off all contact with him. And when he was questioned following Dottie's disappearance, Jewel never made any mention of this fiancé, and no one else found out about it for 2.5 years. Even though the Unsolved Mystery segment did not paint a flattering picture of Jewel, it probably would have been a hell of a lot worse if they had known about the secret engagement when they filmed it. So this begs the question, Since it was Dottie's idea to ask Jewel for a divorce, what exactly was his plan if this never happened? It's not like he could just marry his other fiancé while he was still married to Dottie. Jewel had been writing her letters proposing the idea that she leave Colorado and move in with him once he settled into his new job in Salt Lake City. But what if Dottie had told Jewel she wanted to move there with him? When you look at how Jewel's life was shaping up at this point, it seems more and more like he considered Dottie to be a major burden, and he definitely would have had a motive to get rid of her. But if Jewel was responsible for Dottie's death, the big question is, would it have been a crime of passion or premeditated murder? Well, when the investigation was reopened in 2004, police spoke to a former classmate of Jewel's who claimed that in around 7th or 8th grade, he remembered Jewel writing a school paper titled How to Commit the Perfect Murder, which caused quite a stir in the classroom. Now, by the time the classmate shared this story, nearly 50 years had passed, so I have no idea if it has any relevance to this case. But it makes me think of that strange anonymous letter which was sent to police claiming that Jewel murdered Dottie and buried her body. Now, I've personally seen the letter, along with a hand-drawn map to Dottie's alleged burial location, as they are attached to the probable cause affidavit. On one hand, the letter is so vivid and detailed that you get the sense that it was written by someone who was there and has first-hand knowledge of what happened. Since a document expert concluded that Jewel's handwriting was similar to the handwriting on the letter, it's possible he could have written it himself. Or maybe it was written by an unknown accomplice who helped Jewel cover up the crime. One theory which has been proposed is that since the letter arrived just over a month after the case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, some anonymous self-proclaimed psychic could have watched the show and had their own vision of what they believe happened. But if Jewel was the author, and you're wondering why he'd write an anonymous letter implicating himself in a murder, then the answer to that might be, he's just a weird friggin' dude. I mean, Dottie wrote down that Jewel once shared a story with her about shoving a bomb up a dog's ass while he masturbated. I have no idea if there's any truth to that story, but for some odd reason, I can totally believe Dottie actually heard Jewel say something like that. Let's say there's some significance to Jewel's paper about how to commit the perfect murder. If he killed Dottie and now believed he had really committed the perfect murder and was so certain he'd never get caught, he could have been brazen enough to write an anonymous letter implicating himself just for kicks. Or it could have been an attempt at misdirection in order to direct police towards a burial location which was nowhere near where Dottie's body really was. There are things about this letter which don't make much sense, particularly the mention of an elderly woman who apparently saw Dottie's body in Jewel's car that morning. The letter states that if this woman can be found, she'd make a good witness, but if the author has so much first-hand knowledge about this stuff, then why don't they just come forward as a witness? The one thing which makes me think the letter might not have been written by Jewel is that it was postmarked from Gary, Indiana. Jewel lived in Utah, and while his job did involve traveling, I'm not sure he could be placed in Indiana at the time the letter was sent. So it is possible that the letter was nothing more than a hoax, or it was written by some crackpot who had a vision of the murder, but wasn't actually there. But when it all comes down to it, even if the scenario outlined in the letter did not actually happen, I just cannot come to any other conclusion than Jewel being responsible for Dottie's disappearance. There's no chance that she took off and started a new life. And I don't buy the theory that Dottie could have crossed paths with the wrong person and been murdered by someone else. I'd say the fact that Dottie's Beetle was found in the Concord BART station, a completely different station than where she supposedly boarded her train, pretty much kills that idea. Since Dottie left the Beetle behind at her house, I just don't see how it would have wound up in the hands of an unknown murderer to park there. No, the only person who would have had reason to leave the vehicle in that parking lot was Jewel, because he wanted to fabricate a cover story for himself. But he may have been a bit too clever for his own good. If Dottie's vehicle had been abandoned at the Pleasant Hill BART station, Jewel could have claimed that she drove herself there to take her train trip and never returned. However, because Jewel claimed he dropped Dottie off at the station, and her vehicle somehow showed up in the parking lot of an entirely different BART station the following day, it sounds like Jewel was trying way too hard to give off the impression that Dottie staged her own disappearance. Now, if Jewel murdered Dottie, you might be wondering what his motive would have been, since their marriage was coming to an end, and they were going to go their separate ways anyway. Well, there are a number of possible reasons for why this might have happened, and they can all be explained by the fact that Jewel sounds like a grade A narcissist. Let me reiterate. This was a guy who wrote an 8-page letter to Wendy's because they kicked him out for messing up their salad bar. It's not a stretch to think this was someone who may have decided to kill his wife because things weren't going his way. Let's not forget that for the first few months of this relationship, Dottie knew Jewel by a false name because he wanted to cover up the fact that he was already married. Many women would have taken this as a warning sign to end things immediately, but unfortunately, it sounds like Dottie always struggled with serious self-confidence issues and was so in love with Jewel by this point that she was willing to stick with him until he divorced his wife. She was then trapped in the unhappiest marriage imaginable, in which she became too frightened to even step outside, and was practically a prisoner in her own home, while Jewel was out on the road carrying on numerous affairs. Dottie claimed that Jewel was often abusive towards her, and while it's true that the only documented incident of domestic violence was one in which Jewel claimed he struck her in self-defense, you have to remember that because of her agoraphobia, Dottie did not venture outside much during this time period, and had very little contact with other people. So if Dottie was physically abused, people might not have noticed, and it's likely that much of the abuse was emotional as well. The fact that Dottie joined a women's support group, opened her own bank account, and got her own post office box behind her husband's back are all warning signs that she was concerned about his reaction if he found out. Considering that Jewel refused to grant Dottie a divorce the first time she asked in 1981, it must have taken a lot of strength for her to finally put her foot down about that when Jewel said he was receiving a job transfer. But by this point, she had built up a lot more self-confidence and independence and was making plans for a happy future now that she was free from her miserable marriage. Now, the couple did see a divorce mediator, and on the surface, it looked like they were attempting to come up with an amicable way to end the marriage, which is how they made the arrangement for Dottie to remain in the house in Concord while Jewel moved to Utah. But it was pretty obvious that Jewel was angered by the fact that he had financially supported Dottie for the past decade, and now she was going to get to keep his former house. So there are a number of ways this situation could have escalated into foul play. It's possible Dottie refused to sign the refinancing papers for the home. After all, her disappearance did cause Jewel some financial problems, and he had to use his parents' home to make the down payment on his new house in Utah, so if Jewel had been able to get Dottie's signature on the papers, I'm sure he would have. So it's possible he snapped and killed her in the heat of the moment, but there are other signs which point to premeditated murder. Namely, the fact that Jewel signed a rental contract 5 days before Dottie went missing, even though they had supposedly made the arrangement for her to stay in the house. I'm not quite sure why Jewel signed the contract while Dottie was present, but according to the rental agent, Dottie did not appear very interested in what was going on, so maybe Jewel misled her about what he was doing. Jewel had wanted Dottie to pay him $400 in rent per month in order to stay in the house, though he claimed she tried to negotiate for less. But the tenants who rented the place wound up paying $650 per month, so Dottie's disappearance wound up benefiting Jewel financially, since he collected over $155,000 in rental payments over the next 20 years. If Dottie was killed, it likely occurred after she was last seen by the garage mechanic on June 11th, and before Jewel showed up to work at the Pleasant Hill field office on the morning of June 12th. Since Jewel left work early on the 12th and the 13th, and then took the next several days off, he was likely using that time to get rid of Dottie's body, cover up the crime, and stage the appearance of Dottie's Beetle in the BART station parking lot. My biggest concern about solving this case is that it might be impossible to recover Dottie's remains. Jewel worked for the U.S. Forest Service, and due to the nature of his job, he may have known some ideal locations to dispose of a body and ensure it would never be found. Remember that insurance agent from Salt Lake City believed that Jewel may have subtly been hinting at the location of Dottie's body when he showed her some aerial photos of a forest area, but after all this time, who knows if there's anything left to find. In the end, this is one of those frustrating missing persons cases in which you have little doubt who the guilty party is, but you can also understand why no arrest has ever been made, and why it would be difficult to secure a conviction at trial. Yes, Jewel has told a very unbelievable story with a lot of holes, and he's done a number of suspicious things, but no hard evidence has ever been uncovered to suggest a crime has even been committed, let alone that Jewel murdered Dottie. So until Dottie's remains, or some other incriminating evidence can be found, this case will continue to remain unsolved. This is a tragic story of a woman who is finally overcoming her fears and breaking free from a terrible husband to get a fresh start, but it seems like the thing she always feared might happen probably did happen. Dottie is a victim who definitely deserves some justice, because the prime suspect is now in his 80s, and who knows how much longer he's going to be around. So if you have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Dottie Kaler, please contact the Concord Police Department at 925-671-3240. That's 925-671-3240. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which has a number of interesting discussions about this case, and also the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. We also have a pair of new donors this week, and they are Diane and Dan, so thank you very much, you two. And since we've entered a new month, we would also like to take a moment to thank our recurring monthly donors again, and they are Carol, Dawn, Amber, Brian, Casey, Ellie, Kathleen, Keisha, Laura, Megan, Clinton, Lewis, Aura, Claire, Elliot, Heather, Eleanor, Purity, and Laura Lee. So a big thank you to everyone for your generosity. Need to provide my thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes our eerie music score. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. And you can also feel free to visit our Facebook discussion group if you want to discuss this case with myself or your fellow listeners. I also wanted to mention again that I will be representing The Trail Went Cold by appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held at the Gaylord Opulent Hotel in Nashville from May 4th to the 6th. So if you're planning to attend CrimeCon and you need to purchase tickets to the event, you can receive a 10% discount by using our podcast promo code. Just visit crimecon.com and get 10% off by entering the promo code TTWC. That's TTWC. Like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website. So if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So have yourself a good week and join me next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶